Maybe my favorite Bob Dylan song of the past bunch of years, that's Sugar Baby, as performed by the one and only Barb Unger. She is a cabaret artist, has been starting in London, and really has been touring all over the place, but mostly America the last few years, and specializing in the kind of music that not all cabaret people do. When we think of cabaret performance and nightclub, we think of either people doing the American Songbook or show tunes and Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein and Frank Lesser and those terrific people. But, you know, it was always kind of a disconnect, especially back when I first started going to theater and cabaret and wanting to hear more of the people that I grew up listening to. I was listening to Randy Newman and Neil Young and Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and Joni Mitchell, and not hearing as much of that as I wanted to. So it's really great that Barb Unger has taken that mantle up. I mean, a lot more people over the past few years have done that as well. But she really has made a real niche of singing that kind of music in a cabaret, somewhat jazzy sort of mode. And she's making a special specialty of Bob Dylan, especially in her last two albums, Every Grain of Sand and the recently released Man in the Long Black Coat. Barb Unger sings Bob Dylan, and she's also doing her show now at the Metropolitan Room through October 29th. That's on West 22nd Street in New York. This is what a couple of the critics had to say about Barb Unger's current cabaret show. Frank Scheck, actually a good friend of mine who writes for the New York Post, wrote that Barb Unger's revelatory show at the Metropolitan Room provides stunning, deeply personal renditions of 13 Dylan classics in which every word shines with crystal clarity. And no less than the New York Times cabaret critic Stephen Holden wrote, "Barb Unger, a fearless iconoclast who dives into the deepest waters of popular song to wrest exotic treasure from the ocean floor, delivering a fiery personal tutorial on Mr. Dylan." I mean, if Barb Unger's publicist sat down and tried to write a review, they couldn't do a better job than the folks from the New York Post and the New York Times. So I congratulate Barb Unger on these wonderful notices, and I welcome her to the Daverhood. Barb, are you with us?
Thank you very much indeed. I'm really enjoying singing these songs here because I've been touring this particular collection for the last 9 months in Britain and in Northern Ireland and all around the UK. And I wondered how it would be to sing it here. And somebody, one of my fans wrote to me and said, taking Coles to Newcastle, you know, because, I mean, Dylan is American. But people have been so fantastic. I couldn't have imagined that people would so kindly and warmly respond to what I'm doing.
Well, I mean, Dylan did get his comeuppance in Manchester a little bit many, 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 many years ago.
It was a very long time ago.
So when did you discover Bob Dylan just as a person, before as a performer?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, actually, because obviously I was aware of Dylan as a major league artist from the minute that I very first heard him. And I was an avid music person from birth, you know. So I was aware of all the songs that were hits. I was aware of all the traffic to Dylan in the kind of mainstream. But I didn't get Dylan as in the way that I now feel about him, which in a way is something that's evolved, until I heard Blind Willie McTell. And by that time, I would say that was when it came out on the previously unreleased collection.
Uh-huh.
And it was when I heard that song that I went, I got to go back and listen to more of this man. And I didn't really do that until about 1999. And that was when, and I always think of it as like a sort of born-again experience. I became a born-again Dylan person, you know. And now I can't imagine songwriting without his work, and I measure everything against his work.
Well, let me.
It's unfortunate, really, because quite a lot of other work is wanting in that comparison.
but let me ask about singing Dylan, because one of the reasons they've had a devil of a time putting Dylan on stage. In other words, you know, they've had good luck with ABBA songs and creating Mamma Mia, and with some other artists, obviously the Jersey Boy folks, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. But with Dylan, so much of his material after 1965 is so personal and cryptic, and it isn't pure narrative. It isn't very straightforward. Is that difficult, or does that unleash something else in you as a performer?
Well, two things, really. There's a complete difference between sticking a load of songs together and making a Broadway show. Mm. I have great difficulty with all of those musicals. I think that they're lazy, actually, is what I think. I know that they're very successful, and I'm sure everybody involved with them is laughing all the way to the bank. But I can't think of ABBA in the same breath as Rodgers and Hammerstein. You know, what the purpose of the two pieces in that are doing is completely different. So to make a, whatever they're called, portmanteau musical out of Dylan's work seemed to me to be a mad idea to start with. That's the first thing. Secondly, what I feel I try to do myself is to take the songs that I can sing, because I can't sing all of them, and work with the songs long enough that the songs find a way to sing in me that allows them to live in a truthful way in my repertoire, and that's a very different thing.
Well, how can you tell when a song, I mean, every kind of singer knows this, but how do you decide when a song feels right and works for you, and what would make a song not quite work for you, specifically with Dylan?
Well, I can use an example for that, Dave. For example, you know the song Who Knows Where the Time Goes, which is a beautiful Sandy Denny song.
Sure.
I can't sing that song. I tried and tried and tried. I must have tried 20 different arrangements of that song. And every time I'd come to the end of it and I'd go, I'm not bringing anything new to this song.
Hmm.
And I knew that.
Judy Collins and Eva Cassidy.
Who've done brilliant arrangements of it.
Yeah.
And sing it perfectly well. And I think it's just a personal thing. It's like an alchemy, and I don't know why it happens. I just think it's an alchemy that happens with you and the songwriter and the material and your voice and your capacity to be in a song. And some songs just don't sing for you. You know, they just don't. And it's got nothing to do with your wanting or not wanting to sing them. They just don't do it.
Well, let me ask, Blind Willie McTell was the Bob Dylan song that kind of sparked Bob Dylan for you. What was the Bob Dylan song? Because you didn't put that on your first Dylan album, Every Grain of Sand.
No, I didn't.
You waited.
But I sung that. I had sung that before, you see. I had sung that song with Durga Rising, which is a collaboration I did with Kuljeet Bamra, an Anglo-Asian jazz fusion, which I always used to call Halve Your Audience, because people who liked Bhangra didn't like it, and people who liked jazz didn't like it either, although, interestingly, that is now undergoing a resurgence. Go figure. But I had sung it before, actually, so I didn't put it on the first collection because I felt I'd already done it. And then when I came to make, Walking in the Sun, somebody I was working with said, why don't you do a different version of Blind Willie McTell? And that's when we worked on that particular six-time version of it, because I thought I could bring something different to it again. So I've in fact sung it twice.
Well, I hate to have you wait for 4 minutes, but I think it would be really appropriate if we now play Blind Willie McTell, so everybody can hear your version of the song. So Barb Jungner, if you can just hang with us, let's do a demonstration. And here is Barb Jungner singing Blind Willie McTell. Certainly a very, very different version of Blind Willie McTell than you would hear on Bob Dylan's, well, it was a bootleg unreleased recording thing, but wow, interesting stuff from Barb Junger from her new album, Man in the Long Black Coat. Barb Junger sings Bob Dylan, and you can hear Barb Junger singing Bob Dylan live and in the flesh this weekend and all through next week to next weekend at the Metropolitan Room, 34 West 22nd Street, in Manhattan. You can also pick up Man in the Long Black Coat from Lynn Records and find out all about her at barbjunger.co.uk. And that's Junger, J-U-N-G-R. I am curious, is that, it kind of looks Hungarian, but I don't know
It's Czech, Dave.
Oh my gosh, so how many generations? I'm sorry, you're half Czech.
My dad's Czech, my mother's German, so I'm first generation British, and they came over after the war. Mm-hmm. My dad died 3 years ago. We lost him 3 years ago, but my mum's still alive, and I grew up in a European household. I always called myself a European, but I'm very happy to be British.
Well, a European as opposed to an English woman, or. Right. Okay.
Well,
so
English to me means something very particular, and I come from England. But to be English is to have grown up in a certain kind of England and with a certain kind of English sensibility. And I didn't. I grew up in a household that was full of Europeans. You know, I mean, there was my family and all the people we knew. They were all people from after the war, because I was born in 1954. So there were lots of people in the Northwest working in the mills who'd come over during and after the war for one reason or another. Austrian Jews, German Jews, people from Poland and Lithuania and Ukraine. We didn't really... Irish people. We didn't know anybody who was English. We knew people who were from somewhere else.
Are you... You're not Jewish, though, or partially Jewish?
My grandfather's... my grandmother on my father's side was Jewish.
That's why you got the hell out of Czechoslovakia, I guess. But
they were already kind of in hiding on all that stuff. But you know, there is a homeopathic trace, yes.
So when you were growing up as a child in European England, what were the records that you were listening to?
Well, my mum and dad were because they were European. We went to the opera. Because, of course, in Europe, everybody goes to the opera. Opera isn't a class thing in Europe, which it is in Britain, actually, or has been for a long time. And so we went to the opera. We went to shows. We went to the cinema. I mean, my parents took me, as soon as I could sit up on my own, to everything they went to. So I saw loads and loads of stuff from being a tiny little tot. I saw singers and jugglers and performers. And so sometimes I say to my mum, it is your fault. If you'd never shown me any of this, I wouldn't have wanted to do it.
Do you remember the first singer and or theatrical performance that made a lasting impression on you when you were a tot?
Well, I remember seeing a singer, and she was called Yana, Y-A-N-A. And it was a touring variety show, and we'd gone into Manchester to see it. So I would have been about four or five, and Yana came on, and she was incredibly voluptuous and looked, I guess, a bit like Zsa Zsa Gabor.
Yeah.
And she had a sequined dress on, really tight, sequined long dress. She was, I'd never seen anything as glamorous as that in my entire consciousness. And she sang, and I remember that very clearly.
I can imagine, and yet, in some ways, you turn the tables, because you do a more modern sort of music, and you don't kind of go with the glitz and the furs and the boas and all that. I mean, it's a much more stripped down.
No, but I think it did have an impression on me. But I could sing from being a tiny little girl. I mean, my mum says that as soon as, like, when I was a little tiny, tiny baby, I was singing all the time. My dad said, I would sit you on my knee on the bus and you would never shut up. You would sing and sing and sing and sing. And actually, my experience of people who become singers, they all of them share that. They all of them sang from the very start, from the get-go. I could remember melody. I mean, I was musical, you know. I think it's you have it, you haven't, you know.
Did you ever take formal lessons in any kind of...
Because I learnt the violin.
Oh.
I played the violin for a long time, so I can read music, you know, I could do all that stuff. And then in a later point in my career, I did a lot of vocal training and indeed for some time had a vocal practice coaching other people myself.
Oh.
And running choirs and stuff like that. So, I mean, I really have done lots of that kind of work, yeah.
Well, actually, this is totally nothing to do with my audience. I'll ask the audience to, like, kind of bide their time for a minute or two. I have to ask you as a vocal coach, because I'm involved in a production that involves a one-person kind of show, screaming for, like, 2.5 hours. Any suggestions on basic, like, how do you get through a show where you've got to muster that voice for a great period of time, night after night?
Well, you've got to really make sure that you're supporting the voice correctly. You've got to make sure that you're opening the throat. You've got to make sure that you're not pressurizing the vocal folds in order to get the sound. You've got to be able to do it easily. So, you know, when you watch a person scream in the street, and if you watch a person scream in the street, quite often their neck is all bulging and all the veins in their neck are bulging out and their face is red. Mm-hmm. And that's because they're using an enormous amount of effort to make that sound. You've got to learn to make the same sound with no effort at all. So partly you have to practice. I'd suggest you go and get some training on how to do it, because there is a way of doing it. And because babies do it. Babies scream and scream and scream and scream and scream, and it doesn't hurt them. But it's just about relaxing when you're doing it. It sounds like a kind of counterintuitive thing, actually, but it's possible. I remember seeing a play called Burn This, and it required John Malkovich to run onto the stage screaming and shouting for the first 10 minutes of the play. And he was doing that 9 times a week.
Right.
But without any damage, you know, because he was doing it correctly.
And because he's John Malkovich. But, yeah, no, I mean, is it all from the is it all from the breath, though, or is it the way you plant your feet? Is that
it's
it, too?
It's everything. It's all of those things. It's your planting of your feet. It's your holding of your mechanism. It's the way you're opening the throat. It's the way you're using the vocal folds. It's all of it.
Huh. Okay, well, thank you. Now everybody can listen in again, not just the people who are directly interested in vocal techniques and training. And we're talking with Barb Junger here on Dave's Gone By on this Saturday morning. Barb, of course, talking about singing because she specializes in all of this. So when you first started doing singing, were you doing more of the coffee shop sort of folk pop, or did you really start with cabaret all the way through?
That's a really interesting question. No, I started as a pop artist, actually. I was a pop artist in Britain for a while. And then, it would have been about 1970... I mean, I'm speaking about when I started singing professionally.
Sure.
Would have been about 1978-ish. Punk was happening in London, and the effect of punk was to create this thing which was called the alternative cabaret circuit, which bears no relation to what people think of as cabaret in terms of music here, but was about people who were trying to do things with a politically aware edge, and they were using every single possible performance art form in which to do it. And it was that that spawned the comedy circuit, actually. But on that circuit for about 3 years, I worked non-stop, seeing all this different work every night. You'd work 5, 6, 7 nights a week. Sometimes you'd do 2 shows a night in different places. You were constantly on a bill. What you did 15, 20 minutes, and there would be 6 other people doing 15, 20 minutes, and they would be doing all kinds of things. And I just learned so much from that. I always think that, in a way, that was my university, actually, because I learned so much from that. I learned how to talk to audiences, how to deal with stuff, how to be on a stage. I learned all of that in a way that was very organic. Then beyond that, I became Younger and Parker. I worked with a man called Michael Parker for 12 years. And we sang festivals, folk clubs. We went all over the world with the British Council. I played in Cameroon and Malawi, Tanzania, the Yemen, Sri Lanka, Sudan. I played in all of those places. And then I started to work on my own. And about the same time, I did a master's in ethnomusicology, and that somehow that clarified for me what I wanted to do next. And I started working with arrangers and arrangements, and kind of carved this little funny little furrow that I've been in ever since, which just ploughs forward, you know.
Well, I would love to...
Musical highway of life.
Well, I would love to hear some anecdotes or memories or thoughts on playing at places I know I will never go in my life. I mean, Malawi and Tanzania and Cameroon, I don't see myself getting there in the near future. Any amazing moments or memories from those?
Oh, my God, yes. I have so many. One particular... concert in Tanzania was in an afternoon, and it was right up beyond Mombasa, and we were in this little town where they've got like a little amphitheater, tiny little town, and people came with their goats and chickens and sat in the audience with their animals and their children and food, and so at certain points during the set, some of the animals would wander around you on the stage. It was hilarious.
Oh my! And you just go with it, right? You stroke the chicken, the cow.
One of the reasons that the British Council kept sending me was because I wasn't a diva, so I was really interested to go to these places, and I was really interested to work in places where other people point-blank refused to go, you know, largely because they thought that the hotel accommodation wasn't good enough, things like that. And I didn't really care about anything like that. I didn't care at all. I just wanted to experience. I mean, I knew when would I ever else get a chance to go into the Cameroonian bush, you know, in a way that was completely legitimized. And because I was a musician, people accepted me. You know, they didn't think of me as a white woman. They thought of me as a musician. So I was invited into people's houses. I was invited to see ritual dances. I mean, I was invited to see things. You could live in Malawi all your life and not go to a Chichewan Gulawam Kulu festival, but I was invited.
Well, actually, we had a genuine Gulawam Chuan festival here last week. Go figure. You know, right on the... No, I'm kidding. I went for a joke there, but it just completely died because I couldn't pronounce it.
I liked the way you were driving then.
I try. Thank you. Thank you so much. By the way, we are driving into 11 a.m. here at the University of Northern Colorado. You're listening to Dave's Gone By on uncradio.com, also on Channel 3 on your dorm room TVs if you happen to be at the university. Dave's Gone By. You can find out more about us at davesgoneby.com. You can also drop me an email if you want to ask Barb Junger a question. I can check my email, davesgoneby@aol.com. Barb is going to stay with us a little while longer, I hope, yes?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. So, yes, we're talking to Barb about her amazing experiences traveling and performing. Did you ever have any scary experiences or times when the audience was just, you know, you almost walked off the stage because they weren't paying attention or something?
Oh, no, not in this, but I did have a scary experience in Cameroon one evening. I mean, I've been told that after a certain point at night, the streets are, you know, the streets are owned by whoever's patrolling them. Mm-hmm. And we had been taken out, and my colleague and I, Michael Parker, who is a guitarist, we'd been taken out to a place where you could have chicken, and basically kind of equivalent of a restaurant, but it was right out in the middle of nowhere by the sea. And in order to get to it, you had to take this little lane, and there's a lot of illegal petrol being brought in from Nigeria to Cameroon on tiny little boats. And the government had tried to close the illegal, and it was coming into this little bay, which we had to go past. The government had tried to close down this trade, So they'd sent in a tank with a guy in it, and the petrol pirates had burned the tank with the guy in it and left it there with the guy's body sticking out of it, charred body, to warn people not to try and stop this trade. So we had to drive past this body stuck out of a tank, and on our way to a restaurant, can't make it up. And there were all the pirates were there, and the pirates, you know, they looked like pirates. And I don't mean they look like Johnny Depp.
Right.
I mean, they look, you know, rugged, and they've got big guns and, you know, lots of bullets around their necks and stuff like that. And they came and looked in the car window. They passed us on. They knew we weren't interested in the petrol. They were not interested in us. And that was quite scary. But on the way home, we were stopped by some renegade uniformed people. This was in the city, and they stopped the car, and they said, right, we want something. And by this time, we were just being taken home, so there was the driver and me and Michael in the back of the car.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any money or anything because we'd been taken out, and I was told, don't carry your passport, don't carry anything, you know, just be safe. So we didn't have anything on us that was of any worth at all. And they said, go get out of the car, you know, and I thought, oh, we're in trouble. We're going to be in trouble here. Because how can I contact anybody? You know, didn't have phone or anything.
Sure.
They said, okay, we want something. They meant a bribe, you know. We want something or we're going to have to take you in. And I thought, oh, dear me. So, and suddenly, out of nowhere, I remembered that I'd been on the television in Cameroon. So I said to them, you know who I am. I've been on Tam Tam Weekend. And they said, Tam Tam Weekend? And I said, yes, you know Tam Tam Weekend. I was singing there today, and I started to sing the song. And they started laughing. They go, Tam Tam Weekend. They go, have you got a cassette?
Mm.
And I had a cassette, you see, in my bag. And I said, yeah, and I gave them a cassette, and they let us go.
Oh, my God. But see, it's a happy, wonderful story, but I would have been on the first flight out of that miserable country. and I would have said, I would have been like all your colleagues who said, no, you know, not just the hotels. I'm not playing these places. No, you know.
Oh, it was absolutely great. It's been, you know, in your life's journey, I can't tell you my debt of gratitude to have been able to go to those places.
I guess. I mean, and you still travel. I mean, I assume now you've traveled to more conducive cities around the world.
I don't know, you see, because I was in Australia last year. And actually, it wasn't last year that this happened, but the year before that, I was in Australia, and I was just walking back on a free day. I had a free day, and I'd gone to the beach. And as I was walking back, I heard this rustling noise at my feet. And I'm not kidding you, I saw the biggest snake I've ever seen in the wild just zipping past me to go over a fence and disappear into the undergrowth. I mean, Australia's alive. I never saw anything like that in Africa.
Huh. Well, lucky you, I guess. And it's just, I guess, maybe your philosophy is when it's your time, it'll be your time. And until then, you just have to go wherever life takes you and to go for that adventure as well. Do you have...
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't... Well, look at you, you know. You're living in Colorado now. You said yes to that, you know. I mean, you're offered things, and I think if you reject things, you reject them at your peril, because... You may never get that opportunity again. I mean, not obviously if it's an utterly stupid thing.
Right.
But if it's something that's interesting or you could learn from it, my gosh. My philosophy is to say yes as often as possible.
And I guess when you're a creative person, it's almost more important to be able to do that because it all contributes to the experience and then the way you transmute that backward into art. Or something like that.
Yeah.
Wasn't a joke. I was trying to go for something profound there. I got halfway there. Not too bad. That's better than I usually do.
I think you're absolutely right, actually.
Do you have personal question? Are family, kids, any of that sort of thing?
I have a mum who's still alive,
right.
And I have I'm the guardian of my nephew after his dad because my sister. Well, I've lost both my sisters, and one of my sisters left a small child and his dad. So I'm I'm very much in their family. So I kind of think that the universe said, oh, you think you're not going to have any children? Well, take this. So I've got an 8-year-old nephew now that I have a very strong and personal relationship with, because I have to, because if anything happens to his dad, I'm on the firing line, you know. So, yeah, so that's what I've got.
Well, that's can I ask, I mean, you've lost a parent, but losing sisters, I mean, how do you get through that?
Well, it's, I mean, it was horrible to lose one sibling, and I lost both my younger sisters. It was horrible to lose my first sibling. When my second sister died, I really did. I just looked at the heavens and I went, I don't understand this anymore. I don't understand.
Were they ill, or was it natural, or what? Why?
Well, my sister Christina died in 2000. She had multiple sclerosis, and she died in my arms. She choked because, you know, when you have multiple sclerosis at that level, that's generally speaking what happens, and it was really, really horrible. And I wouldn't wish it on anybody. I wouldn't wish the experience I had or the experience she had on anyone. My other sister died very suddenly. She had a heart attack in the street and died. So Christina died aged 38, and my other sister died aged 44.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. And thank God, you're healthy? You're okay?
I'm brilliant. Thank you very much. I'm very hale and hearty. I shall live to 100. I always know that.
Oh, from your mouth to God's ears. That'd be wonderful. I'm not living. I'll hope to make it to 80. That would be nice. Yeah. With my rage problem, I'll probably make it to 71.
Yeah, no, I'm here for the long haul, you know.
Can I ask, back to the, you know, I didn't realize that we would go to such a dark, dark place, but getting back to the music,
yes.
I can't believe I haven't asked this yet. Have you ever met Bob Dylan?
No, I haven't, but I've had a huge amount of kind help and support from his management team, and just recently they asked for some albums to send to him.
Oh, cool. Would you want to, or would that almost be like you'd be afraid to be either disappointed or you wouldn't know what to say? Your thoughts on that?
I can't imagine one wouldn't know what to say, but the difficulty, of course, is always that you know somebody through their work, you don't know them.
Right.
You know, and if you are around lots of people who've achieved great fame, and I know people in Britain who've achieved great fame, then, you know, you're always aware that there's a very great difference between a public and a private person. So I have no idea who Bob Dylan is outside of his music and songs. So I've no idea whether, you know, I'd like him or he would like me, or we would have anything worthwhile to contribute to each other's being. But what I would like to be able to do is to say personally how wonderful I think his work is. And I hope that if he listens to what I do with his work, he would know that without my having to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what we all kind of hope for, that just that moment to say, thank you. I don't want to bother you. I just want to say thank you. And please live another 150 years or something like that. You know, that'd be about...
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I totally agree. Yeah, precisely. I mean, I really do think that Dylan's work is somewhere else. I don't think anything compares to it. I'm talking about in terms of songwriting in our tradition, you know? I don't think there's anything that's comparable to it.
Well, let's hear...
In terms of its legacy and its profound depth and its subtle understanding of the human condition. And I think it must be very, very hard to live with that level of insight.
Hmm.
You know, it's a Gore Vidal level of insight. It's a Pinter level of insight into the human condition.
Wow. Here I was trying to be profound, and you just nailed it right on the head. Thank you, Barb Junger. Let's hear a little bit more of Barb singing before we close our interview with her. That has just been so fascinating and ranged through so many things. You know, I was going to play Man in the Long Black Coat, which is the title track of your new record, but you can pick one if you prefer. Is there a song that...
I love that. I'm happy if you play that.
Oh, okay. Well, we're happy too. Man in the Long Black Coat from Barb Junger, and we'll be right back with her after this song. The title track of Barb Junger's latest CD, Bob Dylan's Man in the Long Black Coat. And, yeah, Bob Dylan is also, or was, one of the greatest singers in the history of rock and roll. But he couldn't sing like that. He couldn't get that kind of beauty out of his pipes, even in, like, the Desire days or the great days of the 1960s. You need a Barb Junger for that. So, Barb, it's been absolutely delightful talking with you. And one of the things we said while the mics were off is that your next thing is going to be exploring those really like major rock and roll years of 65, 66 of, the Blonde on Blondish era. Is that your next treasure trove to crack?
I'm interested in that. And I'm interested in now his most recent output. So I've got sort of two explorations going at the same time. I'm looking at all of those.
And do you see another pure Dylan album coming out of you, or are you going to mix them up, or do you need to sometimes put Dylan aside and do other stuff?
I think I'd probably mix them up for the next one, but I think another pure Dylan album may come eventually, because I do think that I just love it. I love it. I love his work. I love it. I can't really express it any other way.
Well, and you did mention, and not to give out your particulars, but you also mentioned one of the cool things is because you're such a Dylanologist in a way that fans and people always send you extra special rare bootlegs of stuff, and that's also a learning curve as well. So if people want to...
It really is. I mean, I've been so lucky with people doing that. And people come and tell me stories. Last night, somebody came up and said, my best friend married Joan Baez, and the marriage didn't last, but I just wanted to tell you that. You know, I mean, people come and tell you the most fantastic things.
Wait, was that best friend married to David, the guy who was in prison for the war, or was this a later marriage?
What was David's surname?
Oh, was it Harris, I think, or something like that?
That was the one, yeah. He was Dave Harris' best friend.
Oh, my God. Well, how's Dave Harris doing? Is he still with us?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Huh. Oh, my gosh. Haven't heard that name in ages and ages. Huh. And then what other great Dylan stories have you been told that we might not know?
Well, I was told a lovely story by a man in Ireland who had really, really wanted to tell Dylan how great he was. And he came out of a concert, and he was just walking home. And as he was walking home, he passed this man standing by the side of a car and down a side street. And there was nobody else around, and it was Dylan. And he said, well, excuse me, I just wanted to say, how wonderful that concert was. And Dylan was really nice to him and signed some things and shook his hand. And this man came away, and he's treasured that moment forever.
Well, who wouldn't? I mean, yes, certainly. I mean, and it's always, I always like to hear nice stories like that. That thing of what we were talking about before, of being able to go to your idol and say, not going to bother you, thank you, please sign this and bless you. And the idol being totally cool and gracious about it. But it's also, I've heard a lot of things about Dylan just kind of going off wandering on his own. There was a story in the newspapers a few months ago that he was almost arrested, they thought he was a vagrant. He was in some country or some city, and he was just kind of wandering with his little hoodie, unrecognizable, and the police didn't recognize him until they got to the station. So they put him in their patrol car. He was just sort of wandering around like a desiccated part of the city. And then there was, you know who you have in your patrol car, don't you? And they felt really sheepish about it.
Oh, bless them.
just hysterical. But anyway, Barb Junger, please go see her at the Metropolitan Room, 34 West 22nd Street. She's playing there through October 29th, so you have another week. So 212-206-0440 is the phone number for tickets. Her most recent album is Man in the Long Black Coat. She also has an album called Every Grain of Sand. Those are the two Dylan albums. She also has, well, close to a dozen other records at this point, right?
They're all available on Amazon US.
Great, Amazon.
.com. Amazon US, you know, the US Amazon, you can get everything.
Sure. Right, and also you can find out about all these things at barbjunger.co.uk. So it's BARBJUNGR. There's no E in there. It's barbjunger.co.uk. Well, Barb, what is the direct next thing that I think you mentioned? You're after New York. You're going to where?
L.A. to Catalina Bar and Grill.
Uh huh.
And then, which is a jazz club in Hollywood, and then to Austin.
Austin, is it part of a festival there, or are you playing at a particular club?
I'm playing at Austin Cabaret Theater.
Lovely. Love. I wish there was a place in Greeley that was that would be appropriate for you to play. I'm, you know, there's a coffee shop here, but it's a little on the tiny side, and then the other places are more for rock and roll. But let's get Barb Junger to Colorado because we need to hear this music.
I'd love to come to Colorado. Let's do that.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it has been an absolute delight and pleasure hearing
Thank
your music
you so
and
much.
Talking
it's been,
to you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you too. Thank you, Dave. Thank you very much.
And Barb, may you stay forever young.
Forever young. Thank you.